All right. Well, I think if you've come along to this talk, and if, of course, even a conference that's called Revolution, I'm sure you're doing so because you are generally interested in coming to grips with how we can fundamentally transform this messed up system of capitalism that we're currently living under. So the debate between what is today called social democracy or reformist socialism, as I'm going to be calling it throughout the talk, and revolutionary socialism or Marxism, I think is actually a question of fundamentals. It's not just about different methods to attain the same goal, reforming the system versus revolution, but actually it's about what socialism itself even means. Is socialism an entirely different kind of social system to capitalism, one governed by workers' democratic control over production, a society that aims to end exploitation and lay the basis for a free, development of humanity as a whole? Or is socialism just a better kind of capitalism, where reforms enacted through the existing state mean things like higher welfare, free education, or better healthcare? That's the kind of thing that Bernie Sanders, for example, argues for. Now, the significance of the debate is not just relevant for the kind of society that we're aiming for. It also relates to every single step along the road to socialism, which flows from the methods that we use to achieve it in the here and now. So in this talk, I want to discuss the issues in a slightly different way from what you might expect. First, I want to start by outlining what I think is a fundamental divergence in the starting point of reformists and revolutionaries, which is what social power can actually establish socialism. Following from that, I want to talk about how reformists and revolutionaries disagree on the idea that the working class and the capitalists can never be reconciled, that this fundamental divergence in class interests between bosses and workers also relates to why we disagree with reformists about utilizing the existing state to bring about socialism. And then finally, I want to touch on how revolutions actually happen, what they look like, as an argument for why socialists have to see ourselves as for revolution. So I want to argue to all of you that the starting point of disagreement between reformists and revolution is not really about reform versus revolution at all. The underlying issue is a social agent that you identify as a means to overthrow capitalism. Do you think that political change in society comes about due to the goodwill and the good ideas of enlightened leaders who bestow their blessings upon the masses of people? Or do you see that it's only working class people themselves engaging in struggles for themselves which can lay the basis for a new society? Marxists argue that it's only the social power of workers that can create a new society, one governed by workers' democratic control of production. The reason we think this is not because we have some rosy view of working class people. Rather, it is because workers are the class in society which do all the work, which means that when we go on strike, we have immense social power that no other class has. Furthermore, workers are a collective class. That means that we have to organize and fight together in solidarity and democratically. So as I'll go on to explain, this element of solidarity and democracy also means that when workers attempt to run society for ourselves in revolution, we do so in a manner fundamentally different to the dog-eat-dog, winner-takes-all scramble that is capitalism. But I think in our society, most people think that workers are either too stupid or too powerless to fight for themselves, much less to change all of society. And that's actually the starting point of social democracy or reformism. If that's what you think, then you must look to another social force to affect the urgent changes we know are needed all around the world. Whether that's combating poverty, tackling climate catastrophe, or providing housing for all. If workers can't change the world, then naturally you have to orient towards the existing state, climbing up the rungs of the existing power structure, or investing your hope in some other social force. And that's actually why even in countries where there isn't democracy today, like Russia, China, Egypt, where pretty much everybody who doesn't support the dictatorship there knows the government needs to be overthrown, the necessity of building clear Marxist politics is still relevant. Because the question is always, what social force can carry through the necessary change? Can workers lead the revolution? Or should we look to, young people, the United Nations, or as it's debated in like Myanmar right now, a people's war by oppressed nationalities? In a country like Australia or the United States, though, most people look to the existing and supposedly democratic state to effect change. So the Marxist Hal Draper noted this distinction, rather than reform or revolution, as between what he called socialism from below and socialism from above. Now, I think that's a useful way of thinking about it, but I actually think it's more accurate to say that there are working class politics, which takes its stand on the terrain of what is in the interest of workers and sees, very loud, sees workers' collective struggle as a social force which will liberate humanity. And then there are the politics of other classes, most importantly, of course, the capitalists and the middle classes. So these other classes, in most situations, possess more ideological sway and social power than workers. And that's because they either literally own and control or serve the interests of the owners and controllers of the wealth of society. And that includes the ideological wealth of society. So these are the kind of people like academics, writers, newspaper editors, politicians, union officials, lawyers. That's the middle class. They're the most consistent advocates of the views which form the foundation of reformism. This social layer identifies the huge variety of problems that exist in society, but they're, you know, educated experts, and they believe that their own ascension to political power will be sufficient to resolve the problems. The problems of the system are not seen as inherent, but just as like excesses or discrete issues, which they can resolve. And that's basically the kind of politics that we see today in the Greens in Australia, but also people like Bernie Sanders or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in the United States. However, even working class political parties have not been immune to the pressure of the capitalist system on them. And I've got the example up here of the Australian Labor Party, because that was formed by the trade union movement and still is very influenced by the unions today. But despite being a party formed by organised workers, the ALP and many reformist parties like them all over the world have been ground down into first accepting and then gradually championing the capitalist system. And as it has done so, the ALP has become more and more dominated by the same kind of professional politicians as every other party. So I've got the statistics up on the screen there. Today, practically nobody among the ALP's parliamentarians is from a working class background. The way that capitalism has corrupted workers' parties was different in every single country and in every single instance, but it has been an undeniable feature everywhere. So the reason to make this point is because the reason socialists support revolution is not because we like violence, whereas reformists are for peace. It flows from our standpoint as principled advocates of workers' struggle and workers' interests. We understand that in our society, you have to pick a side, either the side of the exploiters or the side of the workers. There is no middle ground because the bosses literally live off our labour. When workers get a bigger piece of the pie which we have made, that means less profit for the bosses. More control over our working lives, for instance, by instituting health and safety at work, decent breaks, better rights to permanency, that means less control by the bosses over us as workers. And competition between the capitalists means that they are totally relentless and ruthless in pursuit of profit. Did a single essential worker recognize during the pandemic, you know, we all got accolades for our fantastic work, did a single worker receive a pay increase for the boss's appreciation of us risking our lives? No, the companies like Coles, Woolies, Amazon, and streaming services like Disney and Netflix made off with record profits. So I think a really good example of the sort of conflict I'm trying to talk about between the idea that we have an irreconcilable class struggle or the reformist view, which is that classes can be reconciled, is represented by Sally McManus. She's the current secretary of the ACCU, the Australian Council of Trade Unions. And so in the heart of the pandemic, she said, so, you know, she recognized that, you know, essential workers are doing this fantastic work. And, you know, when the pandemic is over, these essential workers, they deserve a parade, the key to our cities, you know, and we need a permanent acknowledgement of what they did to support our country. And she actually, throughout the pandemic, she did not organize workers to fight for their rights, but rather she had a series of meetings with the bosses. And she said afterwards that that was a fantastic period that really illustrated, you know, you could get together and you could have you know, really great conversations with the likes of Christian Porter and the richest people in Australia. And I guess, as I've said, well, what was the results? We've seen the big four banks make profits up to these are last year's statistics, increased 19%. People would have seen the Commonwealth Bank announce a $10 billion profit this week. Rents have been up 18%. Woolies profits up 14%, Coles 17%. And that $140 billion from fossil fuel corporations is just in Australia. So I want to say who benefited from the pandemic. It was not something equally shared. And all of the institutions of our society, which parade themselves as neutral or above the class struggle, and the most important there being, of course, the parliaments, but also the legal system, are either in the business of fooling themselves or the workers for the benefit of the bosses. You know, in theory, every citizen has equal rights before the law. Doesn't matter if you're a billionaire or a shelf stacker. But in reality, if you have access to money, you can hire the best lawyers, draw on the most prestigious character references. Does anyone here actually believe that, you know, Gina Rinehart has the same influence as a mine worker? Of course not. So this understanding of totally conflicting interests of bosses and workers is the starting point of socialists, whereas the starting point of reformism is that bosses and workers can ultimately have reconciled interests, which makes revolution unnecessary. But as Marxists, we know that the bosses and their governments never hone over anything without a fight, and we understand it is only through workers themselves organizing that we can win anything. So take, for example, the current housing crisis. This is clearly a case of working class people's needs being sacrificed so a tiny number of profiteers can continue to use housing as an investment, because no government wants to upset the interests of small number of profiteers. Millions of workers in this country are being driven to the brink. Many of the occupants of tents along the Brisbane River are fully employed workers who simply cannot afford to find a place to live. A socialist approach would be to say, to damn the interests of the profiteering landlords. The first step of any government that was actually run for workers' interests would be to ban the ownership, say, of maybe even two investment properties. This would free up hundreds of thousands of investment properties in this country that could be sold cheaply to workers. We would also need to raise taxes on the rich in order to pay for new public housing where affordable rents could be charged and not extorting the vulnerable. Nothing in this proposal necessitates revolution, but it means building a class-conscious political party which understands that it is the rich who should sacrifice and not workers. But to launch such a sweeping attack on the interests of the rich, we would need militant workers' organisation across society that could push back against the bosses. We know that even when there are small efforts to reform, like Kevin Rudd attempting to implement a mining tax in 2009, how much the bosses attempted to sabotage that reform. They will withdraw investments. They'll threaten catastrophe from their mouthpieces and the corporate media. In order to actually push through any fight for workers' rights, we need our own working class media to provide a counter narrative to the bosses. We need our own collective organisation, for instance, on the housing crisis of construction workers, to perform the building work necessary, even if the bosses refused. So I'm just using the housing crisis as an example. But the point stands for every single political issue we face. Will workers' interests or capitalist interests be put first? Are we going to go to war for the interests of Australian and US imperialism to contain China's rise? You know, all wars, someone said famously once, wars are where, you know, bayonet is weapon with work on both sides. You know, the same question be asked about, will we allow fossil fuel companies and capitalism more generally to devastate the planet from climate change, so bosses can make squillions from oil, coal, gas and plastics? So the real difference between reformist socialism and revolutionary socialism is actually that revolutionaries have a rock-solid commitment to workers' struggle and workers' interests. Another argument put forward by reformists is to say that, you know, we agree with Marxists about the need for workers to have their own independent class politics. But they would say the existing state is itself a terrain of class struggle, which the Workers' Party could try to run for itself and direct in the interests of workers. That's basically like a more left-wing version of the argument. And I've got a couple of people up there who, in different forms, put that forward. The problem with this contention, like the reformists that argue that workers and bosses can be reconciled, is that it imagines that the state itself is some kind of force basically external to society. The reformist argument that is that what makes the current state rule in the interests of the rich is not the nature of the state itself, but the fact that it is dominated by the capitalists, or at least politicians who by social background and worldview support capitalism. In this scenario, the election of a majority of socialists into the institutions of parliament, particularly with the, you know, social pressure of an organised workers' movement as an auxiliary to the reformers, the kind of battering ram for the politicians, would over time transform the state from a servant of capitalism into a servant of the working class. So while these politics appear to be based on the idea of independent working class politics, you know, organizing, recognition of class struggle, I think that actually pro-capitalist politics enters again here through the back door. Because instead of workers being the group that can reorganize society and establish socialism, the social force that holds the power to defeat the capitalists is in fact the state. But the work and the workers' movement is basically imagined as a brute force that can help hoist the politicians into power and to implement their reform agenda. And the kind of idea that the state is neutral is key to all pro-capitalist political theory, because it passes over the reality of how class domination is actually perpetuated in our society. So the reality is, as Marx put it, that the working class cannot simply lay hold of the ready-made state machinery and wield it for its own purposes. This is because the state machine is itself a capitalist machine. From top to bottom, its structure and functions mirrors the capitalist system of which it is intrinsic part. While millions of workers in Australia work for various levels of state authorities, you know, hospitals, public transport, education, government departments, those institutions are run by bosses on ludicrous salaries who are accountable not to their workers but to nebulous ideas about public interest. And I've got the best possible example on the screen right there, which is Catherine Campbell, who was responsible for the Robodebts crime. And this is a person who receives a salary of $900,000 a year, has received such a salary for many, many years. She defended the Robodebt scheme, which, as I said there, had hundreds of thousands of Centrelink workers. Three people committed suicide, but how many more were, you know, just driven to the brink by this person? And she, in the midst of that scandal in 2019, received an Order of Australia from the government. And she's, of course, still received basically no punishment except for having been suspended, you know, having made off with, what, millions and millions of dollars over the course of her career. But then there's the police, the courts, the military, which are actually independent purposely of democratic accountability in order that they are able to maintain capitalist class society despite what government may be in power. And then there's the things like the very founding constitution of states like the United States and Australia, which greatly restrict any even theoretical reforming power an elected government might seek to use to challenge capitalism. So in Australia, for instance, it is actually well established under the constitution that the federal government does not even have the power to nationalize industry. So as Marxists, we understand that the state emerged historically out of the necessity for the ruling classes of different historical periods to maintain their own rule. And that's because society is riven into irreconcilable classes. Therefore, the state must exist in some form to hold down the exploited classes, which are, of course, today are the workers. And this understanding of the state leads socialists to our positive endorsement of revolution, not as a violent means of overthrowing capitalism, but because we understand that only by catastrophic shattering and destruction of the existing state can new institutions of workers' rule, i.e. a workers' state, be established. So what this means is the emergence of grassroots democracy at various levels of the state apparatus and among the working class that would form a kind of counter power to the existing state. And this emergence of what Marxists call dual power has been a feature of all the deepest revolutions in recent history. And there's some talks, great talks about them at the conference. I've just got a couple of images relating to them on the screen there. And this is when workers have actually started to organize to challenge for control of society. So instead of soldiers following the orders of their officers, they organize their own democratic committees to decide things for themselves. At the workplace level, workers begin to run workplaces democratically for the benefit of the community rather than the profit of the bosses. Because as workers, our power is in our collective labor. When we organize to take over society, we do so in this democratic way that is the exact opposite of the unaccountable dictatorship the bosses exercise at work and in state bureaucracies. So revolutions, in the sense of what Lenin called festivals of the oppressed and Trotsky termed the forceful entrance of the masses into the realm of rulership of their own destiny. When given a sense that we can actually control our own lives, workplaces, street corners and public forums become places of genuine debate and discussion for workers who are in ordinary times told to shut up and keep our heads down. And there's so many amazing descriptions of these scenes where the spirit of humanity that blossoms in periods of revolution, you know, see workers assert themselves in ways unheard of in ordinary times. And one of my favorite examples of this is a famous description by George Orwell. You know, he wasn't just a writer, but actually also an activist. And he went to Spain during the 1936 revolution there. And he described every workers and every manner of industry taking control of their workplaces. But the one that stood out to me was his description of how the wait staff at restaurants, they'd taken over even just the restaurants, that they no longer assumed an air of deference to their customers, instead addressing everyone as equals and refusing to accept tips for their work. And in Barcelona, where Orwell was, It was not just like big factories that workers took over. Even the barbers, the groceries, and the cinema were run by workers. So this kind of grassroots liberatory movement is the alternative to the capitalist state. It means the workers themselves organizing to seize power for themselves. So I think we can see again how Marxism takes its stand on the championing of workers' struggles and interests, not in capitalist class institutions or saviors from on high. And then when we get to revolution, revolution itself is actually just the most intense form of the class struggle that is going on all the time in society. It's a product of the intensifying contrast between the interests of different groups in society when great masses of people realize that they cannot continue to put up with the status quo. The reason I'm saying this is to make the point that they do not develop out of the subjective will of revolutionaries, but because capitalism as a system constantly drives more and more people to fight for their rights and their lives all the time. So I've just got a couple of images up there, which aren't even of revolutions, but just illustrate this dynamic of people being pushed into mass action. So that's one of the photos there is from the United Kingdom, where this year, driven by inflation, hundreds of thousands of workers have taken strike action pretty consistently. I could have also put up a photo of France, where they've had general strikes of millions of workers opposed to the pension reforms there. And then, of course, there's the example, this elemental explosion of millions of people in the United States rising up against police racism in the Black Lives Matter revolt. So in all those revolts, the politics that takes a principled stand for the interests of working class people and argues for political solutions that actually wrest power out of the hands of the bosses were a tiny minority. The lack of a revolutionary working class politics has in so many struggles made it extremely difficult for people rising up to find strategies that can actually win because they are so often led by people, reformists, who want to constrain mass struggle into the preservation of capitalism. As Marxists, we see that, we see ourselves rather as doing what we can to articulate a politics that is actually based on class struggle, a politics that can actually lead that struggle to victory. It is only in the culminating drama of revolution that the question of violence, which I've sort of been mentioning time and again, but not really addressing, actually presents itself starkly. Though, of course, actually, all along the line of the class struggle, the bosses are using violence, and they're sending the police to jail people when they're shooting, even sending the army in to shoot people down, well short of revolution. But I would say that the final clear distinction between revolutionary and reformist socialism is that we are actually for the rule of the workers as a path towards resolving the problems of society. And if we're for that, then we have to be, of course, for that rule being defended by force. Because the capitalist class will nowhere pass out of the stage of history without a desperate struggle. If we are for socialism, then we have to be for defending it against the attempts by the capitalists and their lackeys to overthrow it. And, there's just many examples of this actually happening in revolution. If every defeated revolution in history, as a rule, have been drowned in blood. In the recent years, we've seen the Syrian Revolution. The dictatorship of Bashar al-Assad took as its slogan, Assad or the country burns. And they followed that pledge by driving half the population out of the country and leaving entire cities as bombed out shells. There's plenty of other examples. Chile 1973, Spain 1936, basically were reformists who were more afraid of workers than fascism, disarmed workers' struggle and paved the way for decades of bloodthirsty fascist regimes, which buried hundreds of thousands of militant workers. And even Australia, which people think is just like a, sleepy-go-lucky, happy town place, there were huge secret militias and even open fascist paramilitaries organized during the Great Depression, because in that period, the ruling class was paranoid about the threat that an elected Labor government and the Communist Party posed to capitalism. And the threat there was, of course, if they tried to do anything, these fascists and these secret militias would basically crush workers' revolt. So this bears on the question of which side are you on? Are you unequivocally for the workers, or the bosses and their state? And reformists generally, because they see social change as arising not from workers, but from the state, have actually been on the side of counter-revolution in most cases. And the example that echoes the most through history is the infamous assassination of Rosa Luxemburg and her comrade Karl Liebknecht, actually, by fascist militia, but under the command of reformists during the German Revolution of 1919. And yeah, again, there's so many examples that I can only just briefly touch on them. So to try to bring some things together, the contest between revolutionary socialism and reformism, what is nowadays called social democracy, is actually a contest between principled working class politics and a politics that reflects the interests and pressures of capitalist society upon the working class. This pressure leads to the adoption of a range of arguments by reformers that are actually essentially indistinguishable from garden variety liberals on a range of questions, with the word socialism thrown in. These are things like that we can have a fundamentally more just society by reconciling bosses and workers, that the institution of the capitalist state can be made to work for the interests of all. And none of this has anything to do with a common objection that reformists make to revolution, which is that they oppose violence and support the supposedly alleged democracy of our current system. Our argument in response is that workers and bosses do have fundamentally conflicting interests, that a class struggle must and does continually persist in society between these two classes, and that we situate ourselves unreservedly on the side of the workers. Rather than believing that workers are too powerless to change society for themselves, Marxists look to workers' own power as the producers of all wealth in society as providing the basis to organize society for the benefit of all. Revolution for us is an essential element in the creation of socialism, one that emerges out of workers democratizing their own workplaces and setting up radically democratic institutions in opposition to the existing sham democracy that is offered by the current state. And the only time when violence enters the equation for us is that we defend the right of workers to take power for themselves. So if you agree with these politics, you see the urgent need to organize on the basis of workers' self-emancipation. This is obviously the first session in an entire weekend of discussion, you know, revolution conference. So I encourage you to keep engaging with the conference. Thanks so much.